That, Fire said with a grin, is coming from the object. What? The whole thing is mirroring her brain activity? No, it's very localized, Fire said, and tinkered with the controls. The second image zoomed out for a long time until the entire object was in view. A tiny white dot appeared. That dot is not to scale, of course. It'd be the size of Greenland at this distance, but that's the approximate location of the image. He tapped some more, and the image was replaced with long strings of sensor data. Jen started picking up some EM fluctuation in the surface of the object. I mean, in context, it's tiny, but the object is totally inert, and the sensors on this boat are as sensitive as a galactic tyrant's money can buy. Okay, Elvie said. What does she think we're looking at? At first, it just looked like some photons bouncing around, until Jen put together this map. No one knew what we were looking at until Trevon said, hey, that looks like an fMRI. I pulled up the catalyst's monitor, and boom, there we were. Elvie didn't mind space, but the one thing it lacked that she needed right then was the ability to collapse into a chair. She felt a rush of adrenaline that made her hands tingle and her legs go numb. So they're echoing each other? Like looking in a mirror. Oh, she said. Then, okay, that's huge. Oh, it gets huger, Fire said. All across the object, we're now seeing radiation hotspots. He zoomed in on one, and a new rush of numerical data splashed across the image. Like this. He was looking at her expectantly, waiting for her to make the connection. She didn't think she was all that tired, but whatever flash of insight he was looking for just wasn't there. I give up. It took us a minute, too, Faya said. He pulled up a third image. Elvie recognized a ring gate. This is the same kind of radiation that sprays out of the gate during a transit. Almost before the numbers hit her screen, Elvie had it. That correlated to the catalyst. Yes. Catalyst brain, green diamond thing copy, and weird distributed gate-like radiation. Three things, all with the same pattern, Fires said. Elvie pulled the image of the huge green diamond back until she could see the whole thing at once. It seemed to flicker with tiny stars of light appearing and disappearing where the computer marked the radiation spikes for her. This thing is filled with gates? Like, in the physical structure of the object itself? We have a theory, Fires said. He was grinning like he had the first time she agreed to sleep with him. He was a goofball, but she liked what made him happy. Knowing things, and her. It's too early for theories, she said. I know, but we have one anyway. And by we, I mean Trevon first, but we're all on board. This thing comes in contact with a protomolecule-infected mind. It makes a copy of that mind. Then these gate signatures start showing up all over the object. Trevon starts talking about how secure data storage works. You take the physical imprint, that's the encoded data, and you scatter it. You put it in a bunch of discrete storage locations with tags and code built in so that if any portion of the storage system is lost, the rest of it knows how to rebuild the lost portion from the scattered fragments. Elvie, who was a lot more computer literate than Faez, started, That's not exactly... So, then Jen says, a diamond is a super dense and incredibly regularly structured mass of carbon atoms. If you had a way to shift things around without damaging the overall structure, it'd make a great data storage material. Elvie paused, her mind ticking through the implications. A way like tiny, tiny wormholes, Elvie said. Right? We know that the protomolecule builders seem to have had a hive mind or one brain, however you want to parse that. Instantaneous non-localized communication across all the various nodes and entities all across their corner of galaxy. But shit happens, even to them. asteroids hit planets, or earthquakes, or volcanoes, or whatever. Anything that's stored in a single node is lost forever when that node is destroyed. So what if what we're looking at is the backup drive for their entire civilization? Everything they ever knew, packed into a carbon lattice the size of Jupiter. That, Elvi said, is one gigantic fucking logical leap. Yeah, he nodded, but his grin remained undiminished. Totally unfounded. Complete guesswork. We'll need generations of scientific studies to verify what this thing is, and then generations more to crack the code on how to dig out the data, if any such data exists. But Els, he said, almost breathless with excitement. I mean, what if? Admiral Sagale floated beside his desk, looking over navigational charts on a large wall display. Elvi could see a course plotted from their current position through the Kalma Gate and into the hub, then out again through the Tacoma Gate and into the next dead system on their galactic tour. Tell me that this system is the most important scientific discovery of all time, Sagale said, not even looking up when she floated into his office. It might very well, Elvi started. But the big crystal flower in Naraka's system was the most important discovery. It was an astonishing artifact, Elvi agreed, but compared to... Before that, it was the trinary star system in Charon, and the planet where it rained glass shards. That was more just really cool. You have to admit it was pretty spectacular. He turned to give her his full attention. I'm hearing you say, once again, that there are artifacts in this system that are critical to future investigation, Sagale said. He seemed weary and vaguely disappointed. Just like the big crystal flower. Elvi went through it for him, and as she said it, Fias's theory seemed more and more plausible. Sagale stared at her through half-closed eyes as she spoke. When she told him that the diamond outside might actually house every piece of information the gate network builders had ever had, a muscle in his cheek twitched. But that was the only sign of his surprise. That is interesting. Please write up that theory and include it with a data dump when we send everything back to Laconia during the transit. I apologize for lumping this in with the flowers and glass rain. This actually does seem impressive. His grudging admission stung a little, but she let it go. Sir, Elvi said, Met, this might be everything the High Council sent us on this mission to find. This might be it.
It is not, Sagale said, but she pushed on.
I strongly encourage you to send word back to the Admiralty asking for more time. There are 1,000 more tests we can be running while we wait for additional personnel and ships to join us. Leaving now gains us nothing.
And you believe you will be able to access this data if I give you that time? Sagale said.
Elvi almost lied, hungry for the chance to stay a little while longer and learn a little bit more, but no, I can't say that. In fact, it will almost certainly be the work of decades, maybe centuries, to solve this problem, if it even is solvable. But this is our best shot. Nothing we find in Tacoma will be as important as this. I feel pretty safe guaranteeing that.
Then we'll keep to our schedule and see whether you're right,
Sagale said, already turning away.
Get secured. We burn for Tacoma in 80 minutes.
78 minutes later, Elvi lay in her crash couch waiting to drown. The problem with space travel had always, from the very beginning, been the fragility of human bodies. In spite of these limitations, humanity had done itself pretty proud even before Laconia. Now they were improving by leaps and bounds. The Falcon could make the travel time from one system to another almost trivial by comparison to the standard science vessels and freighters of the civilian fleet. A journey of weeks could be accomplished in days. The Falcon would even give most of Duarte's military ships a run for their money. But the price of all that acceleration was the full submersion crash couch, a diabolical device that completely surrounded the human body in shock-absorbing gel and filled the lungs with highly oxygenated fluid to make the chest cavity as incompressible as possible. For days. "I don't understand what he wants," she said.
"He is a complicated man," Faez said from the couch next to hers.
"It's like he doesn't want us to find anything interesting. Every time we do, he gets grumpy."
"You took your pre-flight meds?"
"Yes," she said, even though she wasn't sure she'd actually remembered to. They weren't critical. "I feel like he's got some other agenda he's not telling us."
"Almost certainly because he's got some other agenda he isn't telling us," Faez said. "That can't be surprising, Els."
"It can't be something more important than this," she said. "What would be more important than this?"
"To him? I don't know. Maybe he just hates learning. Traumatized by a science fair when he was young. 10 seconds. I love you, Els."
"I love you too," she said. "I remember when juice was something they injected you with, not something you breathed. I remember I didn't like it at the time."
"Price of progress."
She was looking for something clever to say back, but then the fluid poured in the way it always did, and silenced her. Chapter 6. Alex. The Gathering Storm was the absolute state-of-the-art in Laconian naval technology. The first ship of her class to be fielded, she was intended to be the prototype of an entire fleet of fast-attack destroyers that could patrol the many systems of the Gate Network and project Laconian power to every corner of the Empire. She had a keel-mounted railgun, capable of firing a 3.5-kilo slug every 5 seconds at velocities that would punch a hole through smaller moons. She had 2 separate batteries of torpedo launchers with 4 rails on each, and a fast reload system that could have another 8 fish in the tubes and ready to fire less than 70 seconds after the first barrage was let loose. She was defended on all sides by a network of 12 rapid-fire point defense cannons, and every angle of approach on the ship was covered by at least 4 of them. She was, as Alex's co-pilot Casper liked to quip, a couple thousand tons of fuck-up-your-day stuffed into a 5-kilo sack. Nestled inside the massive cargo hold of the Pendulum, she was also defenseless. Sitting in the pilot's couch, waiting for the go signal and knowing that if someone realized they were there and started firing, he wouldn't even be able to see it on radar, made Alex's scalp itch. The Pendulum fed them her scopes, so they weren't completely blind, but she was a lumbering, heavy freighter. Her threat detection was mostly so she didn't run into a stray hunk of rock. The low-res radar and grainy telescope shots he had to look at did little to calm his nerves.
"So, you and the boss go way back, right?" Casper said.
He sat second couch on the Storm, behind and to the right of Alex's chair. Casper Asoao was a short, skinny kid, with a motion tattoo of a running cheetah on one shoulder and the wispiest hint of a goatee. In spite of looking way too young for the job, he was a hell of a good pilot. Quick to obey an order and perfectly charming company. Alex had rapidly discovered that they had nothing in common outside of a love of flying, so other than a casual greeting, the only time they ever seemed to talk was sitting at the Storm's controls. Alex didn't hold it against the kid. He remembered being a young pilot and trying his hardest to hide his nervousness by chatting up the older officers.
"Yeah, the Gunny and I have known each other for a long damn time."
"See, that's funny. She's captain of this ship, but you guys all call her Gunny. That was a rank or something, right? Back on Mars?"
"Something like that," Alex replied. "She'll always be Gunny to me."
Casper was running the pre-flight as he talked, fingers tapping softly on the screens. On Alex's monitor, the checklist rolled past, each system verified and reporting green before Casper moved on to the next, with Alex giving the final okay to his work. His co-pilot was thorough and efficient. He took his job seriously. It kind of made Alex wish the kid were 30 years older, so they could be friends.
"She give you any hint on what this op is about?"
Casper asked, then threw the weapons store's inventory to Alex's screen for his double-check.
"I show 200 slugs in the railgun mag, 80 fish in the pipes, all PDCs show green and full,"
Alex said, sliding his finger down the inventory list as he went.
"And no, she's an old operator. Keeping her mouth shut gets drilled into those guys pretty hard."
"Copy. 200 in the railgun, 80 torpedoes, PDCs full, and greens across the board verified," Casper said.
"Yeah, but I figured since you guys were friends, maybe she gave you some kind of heads up."
"She did not, and I wouldn't ask." "We'll know when we need to know, and that's good enough for me,"
Alex said. Then, with the pre-flight complete, spun his couch around to face Casper.
"It's okay to be nervous."
Casper nodded. He didn't look embarrassed at all to be discussing his fear. Alex felt another little rush of affection for him. He was a good kid. Alex hoped he'd make it through to the other side of the Laconia business, but the odds on that were pretty short for all of them.
"I knew a guy on Pallas," Casper said. "It wasn't like we were tight. We never seriously dated or anything. But when I'd go through the station on cargo runs, we'd hook up. Ben Yi. I liked him."
A tear formed at the corner of his eye, and then failed to be pulled down his cheek in the gentle quarter-G burn of the pendulum's drive.
"He didn't make the evacuation?"
"Nope," Casper said, then wiped his eyes. "They say that the tempest turned the station into rubble so fast, no one would even have seen the actual attack coming. I guess if you have to go, that's not the worst."
"I'm sorry," Alex said. Everyone on the Storm had their reason to hate the Laconians. Everyone had a story. The only answer for most of them was, "I'm sorry." It felt pretty limp.
"If this op gets blown up," Casper said, turning his attention back to his screens and going through his checklists one more time,
"I want you to know, you don't have to worry about me. If that big bastard Tempest comes after us, the only thing I'll be thinking is how can I make a hole in it."
"I know, man," Alex said, then patted the kid's knee before turning around.
"No doubts."
"Kamal," said Bobby's voice in his ear, where the comm bud was inserted. Bobby only called him Kamal when they were on an op and other ears were listening. It meant go time.
"Kamal copies from the flight deck, Cap," he replied, sitting up straight in his couch.
From the hiss of the gimbals behind him, he knew Casper was doing the same. Even the crash couches on the Storm sounded slick.
"I need a go-no-go for deployment," Bobby said. "Pendulum cuts us loose on your word." "We're all greens up here on the flat deck. Go on your command."
"Outstanding," Bobby said. "Okay, kids, word came down, and here's the op. Listen close, because I don't have time to repeat myself."
Alex hated flying ballistic. No drive meant he had maneuvering thrusters at most. No active sensors was like piloting with his eyes half closed. The Storm had a tiny radar profile for such a large ship. Something about the hull materials just absorbed or bounced off at an angle almost any radar that hit it. She could also dump all her waste heat into internal heat sinks for several hours and run liquid hydrogen through capillaries in her skin, keeping the hull temperature pretty close to zero. Unless someone was really looking for her, she'd just show up as a slightly warmer spot in space with a radar profile not much bigger than a bunk bed. Alex could remember when a destroyer with similar technology had killed his old ship, the Canterbury. How terrifying it had been when a gunship seemed to materialize out of the dark of space and started firing torpedoes. Apparently, that came standard now. Still, he could relate to what their intended targets were about to experience.
"1 minute," Casper said. There was no time for sympathy.
"Copy that, 1 minute,"
Alex replied, then switched channels over to Bobby.
"Cap, we're go in 60 seconds. Your team ready?"
Kids are belted in and ready for a roller coaster ride, she replied.
Copy that,
Alex said, then watched the countdown timer on his screen drop toward 0, 3, 2, 1, Mark.
Mark, Casper said, and the storm flared to life around them.
The screen switched to active sensors and telescope shots of their target, a fat Transport Union freighter escorted by 2 Laconian frigates. Behind the freighter lay Jupiter's vast bulk. And that was, according to Bobby's pre-mission brief, the reason for all the secrecy beforehand. Whether or not they could make their attack run depended on the resistance partisans on the freighter's crew getting the signal out on the ship's course and date of entry into the Sol system, all while working around a Laconian political officer who had been stashed on board. Because for the attack to work, it had to all happen while Jupiter blocked line of sight to Earth and the Magnetar-class battleship parked there. It was a lot of moving parts, any one of which could have failed out at a moment's notice, and launching the attack meant burning some spies in the Union. If things hadn't panned out, the storm would have just climbed back into her berth on the pendulum and flown away, her crew none the wiser, and the spies on the freighter undiscovered. But the prize was worth the risk. A ship directly from Laconia with highly sensitive cargo attached to some secret Laconian project and replacement parts for the Tempest itself. Hopefully, also some of the weird fuel pellets the Laconian ships used that couldn't be manufactured anywhere else and which the storm was getting dangerously low on. Ammunition for the storm's weapons and for the power armor suits Bobby's team wore. Taking the freighter meant keeping the underground's best weapon armed and operational, possibly for years. And, best of all, the political officer. Taking them alive would be a huge intelligence win. If Alex could take care of 2 escort frigates and deliver Bobby's dropship to the freighter.
They've spotted us, Casper said.
No surprise there. With a storm pinging away with active radar, she was lit up like a Christmas tree.
Jammers on,
Alex said, and the storm drowned the little fleet in static, cutting them off from each other and from any outside help. The 3 ships didn't change course, apparently deciding the smartest move was to try to get around Jupiter. It was their best strategy. Alex would have done the same, which was why he'd prepared for it.
Cap, launching you now. Make sure you come back,
Alex said, and hit the button that hurled the strike team's high-speed breaching pod at the freighter. Bobby and her boarding party throwing themselves at the enemy ship like pirates. While the pod burned hard toward the Transport Union ship, Alex fired 2 precisely angled shots from the railgun past it and through the freighter's drive cone. The shots covered the thousands of kilometers separating the ships in a handful of seconds, and the freighter's drive winked out.
Get ready. They'll be coming for us now,
Alex told Casper, and almost as if on cue, the storm buzzed an angry target lock warning at them.
PDC's hot, Casper said.
Alex was surprised at how calm his tone was. For all the sadness and fear the kid had expressed in the moments before the flight, now that the battle was on, he'd become almost machine-like.
Ready for incoming. Tubes 2 and 4 are locked. We should close a bit, cut off their options, Alex said.
The 2 frigates were not a trivial threat, but the storm massively outclassed them in tonnage and firepower, and he didn't worry too much about flying straight at them, fangs out, and trying to end the fight quickly.
Copy that. 1 and 3 loaded and locked if we need them.
Acceleration pressed Alex back into his couch as he closed the gap. In the distance, Bobby's pod had reached the crippled freighter and was firing grapples to lock the 2 ships together. The frigates couldn't talk to each other, but their crews had some emergency plans already on the books because they split up and flew away from the freighter in opposite directions, as if they'd coordinated the maneuver.
They're trying to get on both sides of us, Alex said.
but Casper was already on it. He was tasking half their PDCs with one ship and half with the other. Didn't matter if they came from both directions at once. The storm's flak screen could handle it. Down at the freighter, Bobby's pod suddenly flared to life in a massive deceleration burn. Alex had crippled the freighter's drive, but the ship was still hurtling along with whatever velocity it had had before the engine went out. Bobby's pod was programmed to push back against that speed on a vector that would keep the freighter safely hidden behind Jupiter. Part boarding pod, part secondary aftermarket temporary braking thruster. "We're on board," Bobby said. Her voice phase shifted into a robotic screech as it cut through the static from their jamming. "We have fast movers," Casper said at the same moment the alert showed up on Alex's threat board. The two frigates unloaded their tubes. Alex ignored them, waiting for the missiles to get into PDC range so the storm could chew them up.
"Let's go ahead and start shooting back," Alex said.
And a moment later, the storm shuddered as if with pleasure as she fired four torpedoes of her own. Before the rapidly closing missiles could even pass each other, two of the incoming torpedoes veered off in a wide turn.
"Worry about the two that are still coming at us," Alex said to Casper,
and then stopped thinking about that. The other two Laconian torpedoes were now winging in a wide arc toward the freighter, and the two frigates had also flipped and started a hard burn back toward their former charge. They hadn't been able to draw the storm away, or shoot it down. Their plan B appeared to be scuttling the freighter. Bloodthirsty, but not unexpected. Alex threw the throttle down to catch the swiftly slowing freighter as quickly as possible, shifting from attacking their prey to protecting it. For a moment, everything was falling toward a central point in space defined by the crippled ship. The storm, eight torpedoes on wide, looping courses to find their targets, the two frigates burning back. On the threat board, it looked like the freighter had turned into a black hole, and its gravity was sucking everything, large and small, into its event horizon. In its way, it was beautiful. Then, everyone was shooting. Casper's PDCs cut down all four of the Laconian torpedoes in an instant, even as two of the storms impacted on the nose of one of the frigates, and the plasma warheads turned the front half of the ship into glowing slag. The other frigate spun and slewed sideways and shot down the torpedoes chasing it, then continued its rotation and gave the freighter and Bobby's attached breaching pod a full broadside from its PDC array. The freighter was riddled with holes, and plumes of escaping atmosphere jetted out, looking a bloody pink in the reddish light coming off Jupiter. Or maybe there was some actual blood mixed in there. As many holes as the freighter had taken, it defied belief that no one on board had been hit.
"Splash that one," Alex ordered, but Casper was already saying, "I got that motherfucker."
The frigate killed its rotation with a massive blast from its maneuvering thrusters, then kicked on its drive. Even though it only slowed down, it seemed to leap straight at the approaching storm. The two ships passed at high speed, every PDC blazing. The much smaller frigate was hit by half a dozen of the storm's cannons all at once and seemed to just come apart into a cloud of chaff as it passed by. But it unleashed a barrage of its own before it died that cut along the storm's flank. Suddenly, the ship was a cacophony of alarms, sirens, and alerts from the control panel.
"Damage!"
Alex yelled over the din. The noise was getting gradually quieter, which meant at least the flight deck was in the process of losing its atmosphere. He grabbed his helmet from under his couch and locked it into place. He could see Casper doing the same.
"Damage!"
he yelled again, but heard only static on his suit speakers. He banged his fist on the side of the helmet in frustration, then spun around. Casper was pointing at his mouth and ears, signaling that his suit radio seemed not to be working either.
Alex flipped through the pages of damage reports popping up on his screen and found the culprit. A PDC round had cut through the computer nexus that controlled all intraship and intership communications, and, for whatever reason, the backup wasn't taking over. Maybe it was fucked, too. It looked like there were a lot of flashing red lights on the engineering panel. But the storm would heal the hull breaches, just like it always did, and damage control teams were already on the move to bring their other systems back online. The storm would survive, Alex had no doubt. But the freighter, with Bobby and her strike team on it, was tumbling through space, out of control and empty of atmosphere, and, with the radio down, there was no way for him to know if anyone on it was still alive. Chapter 7. Bobby.
Cap, launching you now. Make sure you come back, Alex said.
The breaching pod shook as the storm cut it loose.
The drive came on a moment later, slamming Bobby back into her couch and leaving her with nothing to do while the battle raged around her. The storm's breaching pod was a little more high-tech than the Martian version Bobby had trained on, but there was only so much you could do with something so simple. The basic concept was a small troop carrier with an engine on one end and an airlock that could blow holes into enemy ships on the other. The interior was a close-walled metal box fitted with crash couches. The flying coffin joke Marines had been making for centuries would have made perfect sense even to the ancient soldiers who rolled into battle in armored personnel carriers with wheels. If you die before you get to the fight, you're already boxed up for eternal rest. People always claimed that waiting for the fight was the hardest part of fighting. Bobby had said it herself as a younger woman.
When the fight is coming, when it's inevitable, let's just fucking get to it.
Once the battle starts, things happen too fast to worry about. The fear is all instinctual, not intellectual. Somehow, that used to feel better. Age had changed that. Bobby had learned to see the quiet moment before the fight as a blessing, a gift. Very few people who were headed toward death even knew it was happening, much less had time to sit and reflect on their life. What they'd done that mattered, whether it would be a good death. Bobby's father had already been a legendary Marine in the MMC before she was born. When his family started to grow, he left the front lines and became an even more legendary training sergeant. An entire generation had learned what it meant to be a Martian Marine under Sergeant Major Draper at Hecate Base, a giant of a man, with a face that looked like it had been cut from flint. He had always seemed invincible. An immutable fact of nature, like the avatar of Olympus Mons, come to life and walking among the mortals. When he'd died, he'd been a tiny, shriveled husk, lying in his bed, hooked to tubes and monitors that only prolonged the inevitable. He'd held her hand and said,
"I'm ready. I've done this a dozen times before."
She hadn't understood at the time, but now she thought he was talking about sitting right where she was now, in the transport, heading toward battle, examining his life as he rushed toward its possible end. Who am I? Did the things I accomplished matter? Will I leave the universe a better place than I found it? If I don't come back, what are my regrets? What are my victories? It was a thing maybe only a warrior could understand. Only those who made the choice to run toward the fire instead of away from it. That made it feel sacred to her.
"This far and no farther," she whispered.
Her litany to the tyrants and bullies and despots.
"This far and no farther. If my life means anything after I'm gone," she thought, "I hope it meant that."
"What's that, boss?" Jillian asked. Her number two was strapped into the crash couch directly across the pod from her.
"Just talking to myself," Bobby said. Then she started to sing. "Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you."
Never heard that one, Jillian said, then sang along, trying to catch the tune.
That new? Sounds belter.
Bobby laughed.
No idea. My mother used to sing it. My brothers were older, and I hated losing to them at anything. I'd burst into tears when they'd win, and she'd sing that song to me. Just one of those things you pick up when you're a kid and never put back down.
I like it, Jillian said, then closed her eyes and started mumbling to herself. It looked like she was praying. Bobby knew she wasn't. She was running through the mission in her mind, over and over.
2 meters through the breach toll to the first junction, turn left. 12 meters to the engineering hatch, breach and clear. 3 meters to the right is the master console.
The other warrior's litany.
There are people I love. There are people who have loved me. I fought for what I believed, protected those I could, and stood my ground against the encroaching darkness. Good enough.
The pod screeched a short-lived collision alarm at them. The storm had sent her pair of railgun shots past the hull close enough that Bobby could have reached out and swatted them as they went by.
Brace for impact, she said, using her sergeant voice, as forceful as it could be without quite being a shout. This was her job now, to seem an immutable fact of nature. The avatar of Olympus Mons come to life and striding through the battlefield. God of war now, shriveled husk later. Maybe, if she wasn't lucky.
All around her, her squad of 6 hand-picked strike team members locked and inflated their couches. All of them wore Laconian Marine power armor, though the blue color scheme had been repainted black. They were, as her father would have said, the pick of the litter. Jillian from Freehold, and 5 of the Belters. The Belters were old-school OPA, grizzled veterans of the endless insurgent war with the inner planets before Laconia came and made that irrelevant. Old men and women well-practiced in conflict. Her total force on the storm numbered 40, and included warriors from nearly every one of the old factions. But for a high-speed snatch-and-grab boarding action, you couldn't find better fighters than Belters.
Battle mode, Bobby said, and her armor woke up, humming with impatience for the fight.
The HUD flashed an ammunition inventory at her, then minimized it into one corner of her field of view. A wireframe layout of the interior of the freighter they were about to board appeared and moved to a different corner. The list of 6 names and the green dot showing they were alive and undamaged scrolled down the left side of her view and remained. Getting everyone back with a green dot instead of a black one was always a mission priority, even if it was never the top. A flashing message appeared in the center of her field of view. Free fire authorization.
Free fire, Alpha Team, Captain Roberta Draper, she said.
Through the suit radio, she heard the distant clicks as 6 suits of armor activated their weapons. She'd never needed to do that as a fire team sergeant back in her Martian Marine Corps days. The Corps issued weapons to people and assumed they would use them correctly and according to their training. The Laconians were much more top-down. Winston Duarte had founded Laconia by betraying Mars and looting the Navy. It wasn't a great surprise that distrust of the people in his chain of command was institutional. The HUD flashed a new diagram at her. The relative position of the breaching pod and the freighter, along with a rapidly decreasing distance to target.
Ready, she growled at her team. Go in 5.
The breaching pod shuddered as it fired grapples and grabbed the freighter. There was a quick sideways jerk, and then the 2 ships slammed together. The impact of the freighter was significant, but wrapped as she was in the soft gel interior of her high-tech armor and resting on the inflated padding of her crash couch, it just felt like a sudden pressure on her chest that vanished almost instantly as the pod lost its acceleration and went into freefall. That was a good sign. It meant Alex had hit his target with the railgun shots, and the freighter was on the drift.
Get ready for the burn, she said.
the last word almost lost in the sudden roar of the pod firing its massive braking thrusters to keep the freighter hidden behind Jupiter. Her couch automatically unlocked and swung the other direction, putting her back to the thrust. A new pressure mounted in her chest as the G-forces piled on. When the burns started to ease up, she yelled, "Go! Go! Go!" But it wasn't really necessary. Her fire team was up and out of their couches the second the thrust stopped. Jillian hit the wall panel next to the airlock and extended the breaching sleeve. It made an airtight seal with the freighter, the deck vibrating with the impact. 2 seconds later, shaped charges inside the sleeve cut a hole through both hulls of the Transport Union freighter, and the airlock door slid open. Jillian was inside first, dropping through the glowing red hole into the freighter. She hit the bulkhead at the first corridor she reached and launched herself to the left, heading toward engineering. Hernandez and Orm followed her. "We're on board," Bobby said on the command channel, back to Alex on the storm. Their Laconian gear was modulating the signal to match the jamming, which would hopefully let their radio cut through. But Bobby wasn't entirely confident in the system. It didn't really matter yet. Alex would be busy fighting the two frigates no matter what her team was doing. Any messages back and forth before the storm had secured the freighter's flight space were perfunctory. She followed into the breach, the other three members of the strike team close behind her. When Bobby hit the corridor wall, she turned right toward the command deck. The hallway they were in was actually the central lift of the ship, and closed hatches marked each deck as they passed. Most of them would lead to cargo space, a few to the crew's living quarters. One would lead to the ops deck, and that was the only one Bobby cared about. Jillian and her team would take control of the drive and life support down in engineering. Bobby would take the ops deck and cut off communication with the outside world. If the political officer wasn't in ops when she arrived, it wouldn't matter. They'd control the ship and search at their leisure. For values of leisure up to maybe 5 or 10 whole minutes. "Watch those hatches," she told her team as she skimmed along the bulkhead toward ops. It felt redundant. Their suits were scanning every square centimeter around them for heat, radiation, even the unique electromagnetic signature generated by a beating human heart. It was pretty tough to get the drop on someone wearing Laconian armor, but saying something reminded the team you were there, that you were in charge, and that keeping everyone safe was on your mind. "Copy that," Takeshi said. "Most of these aren't warm. Guessing the cargo is in vacuum." "Guy in a vac suit coming at us from behind is low probability," she agreed, "but low ain't zero." Bobby's HUD flashed an overlay over a door one deck ahead. "That one," she said, and her team fanned out and took positions around it. In the microgravity of the disabled freighter, they stood on bulkheads around the hatch, weapons ready. No matter what the orientation of the ship was under thrust, for purposes of the breach, the ops deck was down. "Remember," Bobby said, "there are potential friendlies in there." As she said it, a rotating 3D profile of two women appeared on all their HUDs. "Protect them first. Take prisoners second, copy?" There came a rumble of assent. Bobby slapped the wall panel next to the hatch, and her armor ran the breaching protocol that cut through the electronic security in a fraction of a second. The hatch slid open. After that, everyone was shooting. It was a fact of the human brain in close-quarters combat that while everything was generally happening all at once, the mind insisted on trying to stitch it into a linear narrative when remembering it later. In the moment, Bobby threw herself through the hatch and into the ops deck, her team at her back. Incoming bullets lit up her HUD with bright trails so she'd know the direction of fire. Some of the bullets hit her, or her team. The armor thought the odds of taking real damage were trivial and ignored it. 7 people in the compartment, wearing light protective armor. Her suit tagged one as friendly.
one of the two resistance partisans. Five with guns shooting at her. One doing his best to hide behind a crash couch. The political officer, if she had to guess. Her arm moved without her thinking about it, and the gun mounted at her wrist spun up briefly, cutting two of the armed crew in half. The other three were turning into red spray and body parts under the barrage of fire from her team. The whole fight couldn't have lasted more than 2 seconds, though when she remembered it later and her brain turned it into a narrative, it would seem much longer. Less than 30 seconds after she'd opened the hatch, two of her strike team were protectively flanking the partisan, and Takeshi had the political officer shoved up against a bulkhead and was zip-tying his hands. Bobby examined the deck. No hull breaches, her armor assured her. The Laconian anti-personnel rounds for shipboard use were pretty good tech, lethal against lightly armored opponents, but they just fragmented into powder when they hit bulkheads. "Ops is ours," Bobby said. "Engineering is ours," Jillian immediately replied. "We have one of the two spies. You got the other?" "Copy. Our people are secure and we have the package." "Oh, goody," Jillian said. "Can't wait to see his face when he realizes his life just went down the recycler." "Jillian, escort the friendly up here," Bobby said. "Let's get everyone into emergency suits and prep them for the ride over to the storm. The rest of you fan out and get an eyeball inventory. When the storm arrives, we're going to want to take all the best stuff with us, and we won't have much time. Get to it." "Copy that," Jillian said. "I think we win," Bobby said to Takeshi. He grinned back at her. "Easy peasy," he started to say, and then blew apart. Bobby knew intellectually that they must have taken a raking pass from someone's PDCs, but from inside the ship, it looked like the bulkheads on either side of the compartment decided to explode in several dozen places all at once. The room was full of glowing shrapnel, bouncing off walls and panels, and the gray smoke of vaporized metal. Takeshi was a tangle of technology-wrapped body parts, floating in a nebula of blood globes. It didn't look like anyone else was directly hit, but before Bobby could even start to issue an order, the air in the room was just gone. Too many holes on both sides. One moment they were in a pressurized cabin, the next they were in vacuum. It happened so fast it barely ruffled the political officer's Laconian blue suit jacket. "Get them in suits!" she yelled, but it was already too late. She was a Martian. She'd started doing vacuum drills in grade school. 15 seconds and you lose consciousness. Anything that you needed to do had to happen in that first 15 seconds, or it didn't happen at all. Any vacuum suit that is more than 15 seconds away is a lifetime away. All she could do was watch the partisan who'd helped them take the ship gasp out a cloud of mist that was her very last breath ever. The political officer, their whole reason for coming, died a moment later with a look of profound puzzlement on his face. 1,000 facts and secrets that could have meant the difference between the underground thriving and all of them dying in a gulag evaporated as the man's cells gave up. Every panel on the ops deck that still worked was flashing red. The ship was dead too. "Storm, this is strike team," Bobby said, opening the command channel. She heard only dead air and the faint hiss of background radiation. "Storm, come in." Nothing. "Shit," Jillian said. She came into the ops deck, dragging their dead ally from the engineering deck with her. "Did we lose the storm too?" "Shama," Bobby said, pointing at one of her people. "Get outside and see if you can spot the storm. Maybe line of sight comms will work. The rest of you, mission hasn't changed. Get me that inventory. Get it ready for rapid transfer once we find the ship." "Or," Jillian said, "get ready to fall into Jupiter and die because we're way under orbital speed now and don't have an engine." "Or that," Bobby agreed, surprised at how much he wanted to push across the room and punch Jillian in the face. "But until we do, we'll stay on mission. Get the fuck out of here and make yourself useful packing cargo." On the radio,
One of Jillian's squad mates said, "Lots of stuff here, boss. Ammo, fuel. It's the motherlode. Primary mission is fucked, but secondary is a win."
"A moral victory, I guess," Bobby sighed.
"You know who talks about moral victories?"
Jillian asked as she floated out of the room.
"The team that lost."
Chapter 8. Naomi. Communication was a problem. The ring gates created interference that made trading messages across them difficult, and tight beam between systems essentially impossible. Laconia controlled the repeaters on either side of the gates, and Medina Station in the center of everything, the guard at the great crossroads of the Empire. They had eyes and ears in every system, and pattern-matching algorithms combing through every frequency on the spectrum. Saba had been able to carve out a few holes here and there, tight-beam antennas with outdated or compromised security code that could drop incoming records out of the logs, news feeds that could be altered to carry messages hidden in the flux of the image signal. The same old tricks the OPA had been using since before either she or Saba had been born, but updated for the new circumstances. The danger was twofold. First, that Laconian forces would intercept and understand their messages, and second, that they'd track the signal back to its origin. The first problem wasn't trivial, but there were ways of making it difficult. Self-scrambling encryption, interference signatures, context-shifting linguistic encoding. Nothing was perfect, and even with the forensic work that Bobby and her crew had done on the gathering storm, the full extent of Laconian military signal processing was three parts guesswork and one part hope for the underground. But Naomi was confident enough in it that she didn't lose sleep. The second problem, not having the signal traced back, was easier because of the bottles. Naomi had never actually seen an ocean except through a camera, but language held on to things that were long gone. Tight beams still had lines, even though the physical wire that line referred to had been light for generations. Sol was still the sun, even though there were 1,300 more like it, shining down on human heads. Message in a bottle held a whole host of nuances and expectations for Earthers that she could only inherit third hand, through jokes and cartoons and entertainment feeds. The actual bottles she used were the torpedoes that she kept in her container, each of them carrying a burst transmitter and an explosive payload large enough to turn the equipment into bright dust. She'd written the code herself, and she knew it was solid. To get information in from Saba and the underground, all she had to do was listen. It was all there, screaming through the void and amplified on the networks, since she knew which feeds to look at. The gossip and the news feeds and the empty, fluting static where the notes had been tucked in. Even Laconian propaganda. Even sometimes the rebroadcast messages Duarte made Jim send out to her. No matter what ship she was on, the information came in, passive and untraceable. She fed it into the local system in her couch and her hand terminal, more raw information than she could have read in a lifetime and updating constantly. And the system filtered out the reports and information for her to work from. She made her analysis, her recommendations, her arguments for what the forces opposing these new inners should do and how. And when she was ready, when time was short or she felt like she'd come to a natural breakpoint, she would transfer the information into one of the missiles and signal her shipboard contact. Once the missile was dropped out an airlock, her code would kick in. A randomized direction, a randomized number of turn and burns, a randomized length and power of thrust, and a randomized time before delivery. Sometimes she'd drop it off a day or two before she left the system, or after the shell ship she'd come in on had moved on. Sometimes she wouldn't. Patterns were the enemy, even patterns that were meant to cover her tracks.
When the time came, the bottle screamed out everything she'd told it in a single burst. Somewhere in the system, Saba would have an antenna listening just the way she did. Quietly, passively, undetectably. It was an act of cosmic ventriloquism.
And it was how the underground passed information back and forth, slowly and imperfectly, while the enemy could send its own messages anywhere it chose to at the speed of light.
That was what being the underdog meant. The hardest part was the time between sending the bottle out and when it detonated. Hours or days, or rarely weeks of second-guessing herself, poring over her own plans and suggestions, certain that she'd made a mistake she couldn't stop before it rippled out through the systems, listening to all the new information coming in that would have changed one aspect or another of what she'd already said and couldn't take back. It was what she was doing now. Her box had left the Mosley for another ship, almost its twin, called the Bikaji Kama. They were on a quarter-G burn for Oberon, with mining equipment salvaged on the cheap from Mars. The hum of the drives was familiar enough by now that she didn't hear it, unless they were making some adjustment to speed or trajectory, and then it was only when the vibrations hit a harmonic and made something ring. The rations she'd gotten as a farewell gift from the Mosley were Earth-made, rice and vegetable protein and curry sauce that might almost have been Belter food, except for the added raisins. She set her system to local, not tying into the Kama's computers at all unless there was something she could only get there. She had music, soft mambo cerisiano like she'd danced to when she was a girl, and as many news feeds as she could stand. She'd arranged her space so that there was room to stretch and exercise, and she made herself keep to a schedule religiously, pushing herself to a sweat twice a day. She slept to schedule, too, dimming the lights for 8 hours, no more and no less, never sleeping in, never taking naps. Routine was what kept the darkness at bay, when anything did. And in between, she studied her data again and waited for her most recent bottle to break. The monitor showed a schematic of the Bara Gaon complex with both the existing settlement and the newly proposed expansion. Bara Gaon was one of the most successful of the new human systems, with 3 planets already boasting self-sustaining cities, an independent mining cooperative surveying a particularly rich asteroid belt, and bases on 2 moons of the system's only gas giant. The map of humanity's presence in the system looked like the first growth of a leaf, pale, elegant, thin, and promising a greater strength still to come. The initial waves had been led by an agricultural corporation based on Ganymede, and a progressive Muslim community out of the Greater Tarai Shared Interest Zone. The two had managed a functional partnership that drew 5 more waves of settlement in under 2 decades. It was a fraction of the Sol system, but it wouldn't be for long. The expansion plan had been trapped in negotiations for years before Laconia had rolled through, and now Duarte's will was kicking it forward. 5 new cities had been proposed, 2 each on the planets nearer to their sun, 1 on the cooler outlier. A high-end sensor network that would be able to map the system over the course of the next 6 years. 18 new exploratory missions. An increased civil infrastructure rolled out in 2-year increments, with an emphasis on scientific and cultural support. If it worked, Bara Gaon would eclipse Sol system in under a century. It was as ambitious as any plan Naomi had ever seen, and it might even be possible. That ambition was also the underground's best hope. Her best hope. She flicked through the lists of project proposals. She'd been over all of them 100 times. Every phase had its own requirements. The sensor network alone was slated to hire 130 engineers and subject specialists, and while the network's primary function was mapping, it didn't take a genius to see its potential as system surveillance.
It would make the Underground's covert operations in Barah Gaon Complex easier if between 10% and 20% of those engineers and specialists also answered to Saba. She'd put together her own map of the project, not impeding the expansion, but taking control of it from within. The personnel directorate of Barah Gaon was her first target. They were already putting out requests for applications, beefing up the bureaucracy that would be evaluating new hires.